Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00079. Recorded on May 8, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 79. Earls of Wisdom, Part 1. Earls of Wisdom, Part 1. Chapter 79.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Post Harlan Monologics. I am your host, Maverick 88. I'm going to just dive right on in here. I've noticed something in the past couple of years, something in DFW that I had not noticed before. It's kind of, I don't know if it's a COVID thing. I don't know if it's a post-COVID thing, right? Post-COVIDian, right? That's a Maverick 88 dictionary word, post-COVIDian. Considering getting it trademarked, but until then, hey, free to use, right? Post-COVIDian. Something with that COVID era somehow, some way popped open this lately trend of intersection panhandlers, right? I don't have a better word for that right now. It's just your panhandlers that'll hang out at a busy intersection in your town. And, you know, when the light is red, there you are. You're stuck. You're caught three cars in front of you, two cars on the side, and there's nowhere for you to go. And they're right there holding up a little cardboard sign that you can't hardly read. And they're panhandling, right? Never used to see this around. Not around here. Closest I can remember in my life was up in New York City. You had the windshield washers, right? You get stuck at a traffic light like that at an intersection. And while you're pinned and you can't go nowhere, homeless person just comes up to you and just starts spraying your windshield. They start wiping it down. And before you can drive away, they're at your window expecting payment for it, right? You didn't ask for it. They just do it and then they want payment. And then if you don't pay them, they'll kick your car. Shit like that, you know. A similar mentality to what lot lizards are to truck drivers. You know, they're imposing their services on you in exchange for the money that they so desire. But anyway, this lately trend. I don't remember seeing it before around the DFW area. And in these past 2, 3, 4 years, the closer you get in towards the city of Dallas, the more you start to see it. And I live in the next town out from Dallas. Certain sections of it you started to see, right? Some of the really, really bad places. And then it's actually come all the way up, like, to my neighborhood and everything, and beyond. It's like two desperados driving by, and they see one person making money on an intersection like that. They get the idea to go do it themselves somewhere else. It becomes a contagion, right? And it used to bother me, right? You know, just people with their hand out in general always had a way of bothering me. And particularly people who weren't willing or able to, willing, you know, if you're not able, that's another thing. But if you're not willing to go get a job and make the money, and you'd rather just stand out in 110 degrees with the sun frying down on you and with your hand out with a little sign and some kind of story to go with it, because you got to have a story, right? That's the hustle. And I had this attitude, no, I work, I bust my ass for this money. I'm not giving it away to you. You suffer like I had to suffer, because I did. You know, when my hand was out, who was throwing dollar bills at me? Nobody. I got all the help I ever got from family, generally, and then later on in life, from church. But these are people that will help you as long as you're willing to help yourself, right? Like the old expression goes, God helps those who help themselves. Well, really, that's what people do. You know, people who care about you enough, they will help you so long as their help gets someplace. Their help shows results. You know, people don't want to throw their stuff away to have you piss it off sticking a needle in your arm, right? And that's kind of the argument that you'll get when you're talking about street people and homeless, right? And there's a difference between the two. Somebody who's homeless lost their home for one reason or another. Lost their job, got alimony, child support, can't make the payments, out on the street. It's a hard luck story. And the person willing to work for it if they can just get a job. That's your homeless person, right? And everybody wants to help that. And then you got the street people, people that don't give a shit. They're on drugs. They don't mind sleeping in a dumpster. They don't mind stealing whatever they can get their hands on, right? So it's a whole different practice going on there with a whole different intent. And now you, as the quote-unquote giver, have to discern which is which and who is who. And I had gotten to a point where I ain't discerning nothing. You get your hand out, you could just keep on going, right? And I'm not like that anymore, you know? Like I said, this used to bother me. I had a real resentment about it because I was never one to really receive much in the way of help when I needed it, outside of the examples I gave you. My family was there for me to a point, and then a church was there for me when I got into another bind, right? But Joe Q. Public, John Q. Public, whoever Q. Public, they couldn't give a shit about me, and I wouldn't bother, right? And this is an important fact related to all this discussion right here. I would never bother to go panhandle. I wouldn't do it. So now you got to think, wow, somebody actually desperate enough to bring themselves to panhandling? There's got to be some kind of hurt in there, right? And here's where I'm going. Now, I learned in my Orthodox Christianity, you know, giving is a big deal, right? Always, to everything, all the time. And I've even got myself set up where I'm giving like extra money to the church every month. That just goes for redistribution to people in need. But I learned something else from this particular Orthodox abbot, right? It's like the boss monk dude out from Seattle, right? Off of some island off of Seattle out there. Abbot Trifon is his name. He's got quite a worldwide web presence, you know, on all the social media and everything like that. But I was listening to him as he was teaching a lesson about how he deals with this stuff and where his head is at when he's dealing with this stuff. And the mindset is, if somebody's in a need and they're asking, they got their hand out, they're panhandling, they're desperate enough to pose themselves in that manner, give them something, right? And what this guy taught beyond that was always have something in your pocket ready to give, with the expectation that somebody's going to be out there in need. And it's not for me to judge what this person may or may not do with their money. It's not for me to really give a damn what they may or may not do with their money. That's between them and God and the devil, right? But my job is to put that money into the equation and let him sort it all out, right? Now, I could be resentful with the idea that I'm going to give this guy money. He's just going to party it up. And that's just, you know, that may be an hour of my work week I just pissed away to help keep somebody on drugs, right? We can justify and substantiate this till the cows come home. And in the end, what we're going to do is hold on to our money because there's that greedy nature, right? Now, I'm not a big-time money person. I don't suffer from greed so much like people are apt to do otherwise, but we've all got a little bit of it in us, right? Especially when we work so hard for it, to just turn around and give it away. But it turns out that that's a blessing. And by blessing, I don't mean, you know, the power of attraction in the universe or anything, which I'm going to get into, okay? I wouldn't mean to get into it right here, right now. But I don't mean, look, I'm going to hand this homeless person, this street person, a 20, because that's all I got on me in cash. I'm going to give him a $20 bill. Which is a good hunk of change right there, right? And then I expect for God to turn around and give me 200 because of the benevolence in my heart. No, that's not what blessings are. So many people are looking for blessings and they look at it in that regard. Secular, Christian alike, and other kind of religions alike. The blessing is somewhere within the tranquility and really the connectivity with Christ. In performing merciful acts, we just open up ourselves more completely with God. And when we have that connection, we are animated, fulfilled. You know, there's a fulfillment that comes. It's more than just a feeling. It's a way of being, right? I'm not doing it for good feelings. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. And when you do these right things, you're on the side of righteousness. And when you're on the side of righteousness, that's what it's like, right? That's what it's like. So, it used to bother me. Now I'm kind of sympathetic with it. It's an interesting thing. I'm thankful in my life that I finally got myself in a position where I am a quote-unquote giver rather than a quote-unquote taker. Right? So often throughout my rambling in life, the rolling stone life that gathers no moss, I was in positions where I needed my family, I needed the church, I needed some give, I needed benevolence from others. But now I'm the guy in a position to give. There's a gratitude in that, you know, making that switch. So there is a sympathetic part of me to the plight of these quote-unquote desperados, right? These are people in desperate situations. And again, I'll get into more of that as we go also, but I'm thankful to be a giver. When I see these people, it doesn't aggravate me any longer. That's the blessing, like I said. It's a real gift of orthodox understanding of things. It takes that aggregation away from me. The aggravation that remains, however, right? And it's relative to this too, because this is a traffic stop situation. We're stopped in traffic at an intersection. That's what I told you. We're at an intersection, and there's some kind of street person or homeless person, a panhandler, with their hand out, with their little sign. That's right in the flow of traffic. That is a very dangerous place to be on a lot of levels, right? And when I encounter it, it's 50-50. I may be on my commute home from work. You don't want to be standing on some little tiny median on a highway where I'm raging through, pissed off at everybody, because that's how I go. That's what it looks like on my commute. This is probably not the first time I'm saying it. Yeah. I'm really aggravated, not from the have-nots, but from the quote-unquote haves. Those who have stuff. They have a car. They have a job. They got bags of groceries in the trunk. They have a home to go to, right? These are the people that really aggravate me. And it's not because I'm sitting there watching as the guy goes up window to window and they're not handing dollar bills out to him. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about just the way these people roll through life in general, right? It's a commuter aggravation. For me, it's a matter of poor traffic flow. It may be my inner Marine, right? I was in the Marine Corps when I was young, and I was trained and disciplined in certain ways. It gave me a certain backbone, gave me a certain outlook. And everything is about moving everything with the most efficiency possible, right? There's definitely that aspect to me. That is a keeper. That will never go away. That became a part of me through my experience in the military. So when I'm driving in traffic and you got three lanes in front of you, and say there's six cars, and you got two cars in every lane and they're all going the same speed, you got a traffic flow problem, because anybody who wants to go a little faster cannot. They're blocked. It's a rolling wall. And it makes me crazy because these people are not present beyond the confines of their automobile. They are so into themselves and their focus, they're not present with what's going on around them. They're not making space for having to divert. Say all of a sudden they come up on like a broken hubcap in the middle of the road, or a box of screws that fell off of somebody's work truck. When they want to go swerve into the next lane, there ain't nowhere to go because they're riding right along somebody else. If you're all going to be going the same speed, why not just get all in the same lane and get behind each other and go the same speed? Now you got two lanes open for other people to pass if they need to go faster for some reason, right? And it's the old rule. It's the old rule of the road. Drive right, pass left, right? If you're all going the same speed, get behind one another. Don't ride side by side down the road like that, you know? So the commute home ends up being an obstacle course. And you don't want to be a panhandler in the middle of it when I'm flying around lane to lane, cutting people off, cussing people out, trying to teach them how to drive. I'm serious about this. This is a real pain in my ass. I don't like it. I don't like that part of myself. But that is paternal. That is a man trying to teach ignorant children in the propriety of existence, right? I take that responsibility on my shoulders. I'm one of the guys that I want to be able to get to where I'm going in the most efficient manner. If I'm allotted to go 50 miles an hour down a road, I know the cops are going to let me get 55, maybe 57 out of it before they start wondering if I'm going too fast or not. It's just the way it rolls around here. It's not worth their bother to pick you off for a couple of miles an hour. Because while they're wasting time with you, somebody can go blazing by at 75. And they will, because you see the only cop around has got somebody else pulled over. That's not worth their bother. There's not a whole lot of revenue that comes from it. You put yourself as a police officer in danger, right? Every time you have somebody pulled over, there's all kinds of danger. Make it worth your while. And I think there's a lot of people that don't realize it. For example, where I live, there's a lot of Mexicans, all right? They just are. It's a cultural phenomenon, right? It's Texas. It's a border state with Mexico. We've got a lot of Mexicans, first generation, eighth generation, and everything in between, you know? And it seems to be a cultural distinction amongst Mexicans for one reason or another. We could speculate on what those reasons may be. That they always seem to be driving around 10 miles an hour under what the posted speed limit is. Like, they're obviously trying to avoid confrontation with the police at all costs. They will go that slow, right? That's how it looks to me, and that may be realistic. They may be afraid of the harassment that comes along with being pulled over with the police. Some of them may be in the country illegally. Some of them may be related to people who actually or live with people who are in the country illegally. They just do not want to bring the police and the courts into their life. And it's such an important matter that they go to that extreme, to go 40 when the speed limit's posted at 50. And they will ride side by side in all the lanes, because that's a lot of these. All right, that's one example, right, of an aggravation, right? There's somebody who's going so much slower than the posted speed limit is, and there's so many of them, so it's like every other car is like this, right? And then you got the Stivics of the world. You know who the Stivics are, right? Stivic, meathead from All in the Family, right? Archie Bunker and his son-in-law, the meathead. It was Michael Stivic was the character's name. Well, he's basically the hippie, right? The hippie, you know, the liberal leftish voice of reason. You could even call it the Jewish voice of reason. You've heard me talk about that on previous episodes. But I'm not saying every Stivic is a Jew. Though what they are basically hippies, they're liberals. how do I describe? I talk about them, pardon me, when my wife and I go out to like flea markets, right? At flea markets, they're always the booth with the CBD and the occult stuff, and they're selling, you know, rocks and stones and incense and, you know, anything that's related to, like, smoking weed, partying it up, and all kinds of leftist hippie and fag stuff, right? These are the Stivics. And the Stivics drive around, they might butt up right against a speed limit but go no faster. Like, the law really matters to these people, right? And they take it upon themselves to make sure everybody else is abiding by that same law. And I think what the truth of the matter is, hey, these people are stoners. These people are mentally ill. They're on psychotropic medication, either prescribed or not. And it's usually compounded, right? In other words, they may be on Prozac on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're smoking weed and stoned, right? So multiple drugs are compounded. Their doctor on top of their doctor, which is gay, I guess. It sounds gay. But I get it. I was a garbage head when I was a kid. And I was a Stivic, too, but I never had this driving problem. What the problem is they're stoned. They're stoned, and they're not fully present. The reaction time is a lot slower. They cannot go faster than they're going because they just can't take all the information in. And then they resent everybody else who are, like, you know, straight edge, like me. I'm alert. I'm present. My phone is in my pocket. It's not even out, you know. And I am driving for the sake of getting to where I'm going. And I'm doing it in an efficient manner, like a Marine Corps drill instructor. I just, you know, it's like the gym teacher on Beavis and Butthead versus Beavis and Butthead. You know, this is what you're dealing with on the road, right? The Stivics. And they seek to control the flow of traffic by blocking the lanes. And if you're there cussing them out, they're the ones who will slow down even slower. And if you try to go around them, they will go in front of you. You know, they will mess with you. They will mess with you on purpose. Right? And you got just plain old city folk in general. People who just live in the city all the time, they're used to driving side by side, right? I was complaining about the whole side by side thing before. That's how they go. That's how it keeps them straight. If you give them too much room left or right, they start to drift. They don't know how to stay in their lane. It's like they need the presence of somebody beside them to keep them going in the right direction. I observed this up in the Jersey area, New York City area, in and around New York. It was like that. The people from the city had to be driving alongside other people. The further they got away from New York into Jersey and things started to open up, you start getting like hay fields and country and mountains and shit, the crazier they seemed to get. They just didn't know what to do without the guidelines of and parameters of people riding alongside of them. Very strange, but very true, right? Very real. Yeah, I mentioned the prevalence of psychotropic drugs with as it relates to the Stivics, the hippie types, right? But it goes beyond that. Half the world, if not more, is medicated continually. Everybody seems to have psychiatric problems that are being addressed. And of course, you know, if you've ever even began to enter into that quote-unquote system, they get you quickly on drugs. You go from a therapist to a psychiatrist to on drugs within 2 weeks. No matter what, you know, if you got any kind of issue at all that you need to talk to somebody about, they will get you on drugs for one way, shape, or form, for whatever kind of excuse that they can invent. It's crazy, but it's true. So people are driving around like that. Stivics or not, prescribed or not, they're on drugs of some sort of type. You're always going to have the random senior citizen in the mix. You know, the people that are too old to be driving in general. But if they just kind of putter around, like, you know, between 10 and 11, 11:30 in the morning, they putter around between like 1:30 and 3:30 in the afternoon, the roads are kind of open, everybody's kind of worked, there's no commuting going on, they're not really a problem, you know? But when they get themselves found in commuter traffic, holy shit, you know, you're wondering, all these brake lights are going on, people are diving in and out of lanes, everything is getting crazy. And then you finally get up and there's this one little old biddy up there who's got her nose like on the steering wheel. She has nothing. She can't tell what the hell's going on. You know, what can you do? What can you say? Person should not be on the road at that time. And there they are. But it happens, right? And then, of course, you know, in this area, the way DFW is growing in leaps and bounds and the urban sprawl of it all, we've got a melting pot society that's grown up here in the past like 10-12 years. people from all over the world are coming in all the time on a daily basis, and they all have their own practices, their own standards, or lack thereof, really, generally, is what the case is. It's never seemingly drive right, pass left. It's just get on the road and try not to hit anybody while you're going where you're going. There's just no real rules, you know? I know some countries in the world, they don't even have, like, designated directions. You make a five-lane road and everybody just goes whichever way in whichever direction. There's no, like, we got the Highway 78. You have 78 north, 78 south. There's no north and south. There's just 78. And if you're heading north, you can be all the way over to the left. You could be all the way over to the right. It doesn't matter. It's just a mishmash. And it's like a parking lot where everybody's moving. It's craziness. And then they come over here, right? Holy shit. So it's every day for me, it's 20 minutes of aggravation, right? And I got this commuter hatred that goes with it, you know? And right when I get to that point where I meet up with the panhandlers, and it's not an everyday thing, but when they're there, they're at a certain place on my commute. So what happened right there is a couple highways merge together and become one, right? Right at a traffic light. You come out at a traffic light, now you've got all this stuff merging all at once with all these kind of people I just described to you, with all their different conditions and their different situations, their different approach to life, their different cultures and mentalities and all this stuff. They all trying to, you know, the ones on the right are trying to get to the left, the ones on the left are trying to get to the right, the ones down the middle are just trying not to get hit by anybody, and it's a sort of bedlam. And all of a sudden, like, the stress factor, it compounds exponentially, and I don't get but a couple hundred feet through that intersection before I finally lose my shit. And it happens almost every day. You know, it's like I leave my job and I'm like, all right, today I'm not going to be cussing out people. I'm just going to exhale and just glide in behind somebody and just go to speed limit and just cruise home without getting all aggravated. It never works. It never works. But I sit on my hands and I hold it in, and I don't get too pissed off. I don't start hollering. I don't get the window down with the Jersey bird flying out. I don't get crazy. But when I get up, we got this, you know, I get through the intersection where the panhandlers are, and then there's like this China buffet on the left. As soon as I hit there, that's it. That's all I can stand. I can stand no more. And I lose my shit on that spot every night on the way home. Then it gets serious. The window's down, the volume's up. I don't need to honk at people. I yell so loud, and people hear it, even over their music and everything like that. You can ask my wife. She's seen me in action. I can get pretty scary, right? But what I realized, you know, dialing it back to, like, the homeless people out there, right? The resentment I had with that. There's a little hatred involved with all that. When I would hand somebody money out the window, sitting there at a light, you can see the look on their face, the gratitude that comes with it. Whatever I may imagine their situation to be, and sometimes they will quickly tell me what their situation is. They become real, right? You see what I'm saying? They become real. They're not just some artificial intelligence, non-player character standing there on the side of the road or in the divide of the road, as the case may be, in the median. They're real human beings with a real soul, with a real heart that are really suffering and that they're really in need. And a connection established. And that's why I favor these people over the general motorists otherwise, because I'm never really personal with those motorists. Every once in a while, somebody will pull up and roll the window down. Oh, I like your truck. Oh, I like your bike, you know, if I'm out on the Harley or something like that. And then also it's like, you know, your eyes connect and, like, these are real people. Whole different feeling. But until that happens, these are not even real in my mind. Is that insane, or are we all like this, right? It's very so impersonal that it's nothing for me to let my hatred fly. It's almost like I want to use my hatred, my rage, to have a conversation with these people to make that connection and to try to clear things up and make it right, you know? That's the nice way of looking at it. A not so nice way of looking at it is, I just want to go on a rage, you know. I haven't had the conversation. Me and my wife were driving around the other day. You know, like, you know, I got all these hobbies. I can't keep up with them. I'm thinking maybe I just get rid of like six of them, like half a dozen of them, half the hobbies. And use the time that I would normally allocate to that shit to working persistently at developing a disintegrator ray gun, right? That can be mounted on the front bumper, and just want to get in traffic. Instead of getting all pissed off and everything, they're gone. Not a trace, no nothing, no evidence, just gone. Just gone. But until I do that, it ain't happening. And no violence actually comes out of it unless you regard, and you probably should, the emotional damage I do with my yelling and screaming. I'll scare the hell out of you. And there's something damaging to the psyche about that, and if you're on the receiving end of it, I'm sure. There's also something damaging to my psyche when you've pushed me to that point. So I get home, right? I get home to my wife, and a lot of times, you know, we both have that same issue. How was your day? The commute, you know? We get into that, and then we'll sit down, and then we'll blow off steam playing, like, violent video games where we can take it out on very impersonal characters, right? And again, no harm, no foul. What are you killing? It's just a digital, it's, you know, cartoons. It's nothing. There's no soul. But you go through, like, carrying out the acts and the actions, I should say. Unless your video game provides you with an axe that you can use. I know some that have chainsaws. It's a pretty good way of blowing off steam, I guess. But we'll do that. You know, we'll sit down. We'll play a video game that has a lot of violence in it, and there's something kind of therapeutical. It unwinds the stress. It lets it out. Lets you air your things out without hurting anybody, and we laugh alongside of each other. It actually creates a certain bond with us also, right? So it's pretty cool. And so lately, our video game of choice has been, drumroll please, Grand Theft Auto 5, right? Grand Theft Auto number 5. Grand Theft Auto 5 is a 2013 action-adventure game developed by Rockstar North and published by Rockstar Games. Set within the fictional state of San Andreas, based on Southern California, the single-player story follows three protagonists: retired bank robber Michael DeSanta, street gangster Franklin Clinton, drug dealer and gunrunner Trevor Phillips, and their attempts to commit heists while under pressure from a corrupt government agency and powerful criminals. Players freely roam San Andreas's open-world countryside and fictional city of Los Santos, which is based on Los Angeles. Based on Los Angeles, California. So some nights, if you were to be a fly on the wall in our residence, you would find us living out our lives in the alternate reality village of Sandy Shores. Sandy Shores. Sandy Shores is one of these fictional towns within the confines of Grand Theft Auto 5. And it's based on towns in actuality, right? And, you know, like real actual towns. This particular one, Sandy Shores, is based on a couple of communities, if you can even call it that anymore, around the Salton Sea, right? The Salton Sea in California. By appearance, it looks to mostly reflect a little town called Bombay Beach, California, right? Bombay Beach. And can probably say it has some trace elements of some of the other villages in the nearby area, right? Now, the Salton Sea, it's a peculiar story, right? Oh, a little bit more than 100 years ago, as the story goes. Now, we're talking about the desert, right? This is the Mojave Desert, Imperial County, California, which is the southeastern corner of California, right? So it's kind of like where Arizona, California, and Mexico all come together. And the Colorado River flows out of Colorado, the Colorado Rockies, empties out into the, what the hell is that? The Sierra Cortez, Baja California, out that way, right? And it comes very near, in proximity, to where the Salton Sea now is. In fact, so near that once upon a time, a little bit more than 100 years ago, there was agriculture that was developed in the area, in spite of the fact that it was desert, by ambitious and creative people developing a canal system which worked off of the waters of the Colorado River, right? So they built this canal system out to irrigate fields, and they started growing stuff. And that was all good and fine until one year, massive flooding came down the Colorado River, and it overwhelmed the canals, and it found its low into this, I guess it was a salt lake bed that was all dried up, like prehistoric lake or inland sea or something. And all the water ran down through the canals into the basically a bowl and filled it up. Now, this basic bowl is something like 15 miles wide and like 20 something miles long. It's big, right? And deep. And it got all filled up with all this flood water. And because it's an arid area, there's no waters that actually come and replenish anything that evaporates away, right, out in the middle of the desert. So what happened as the years started going by, right, you had this brand new sea that was created, which was really an old sea. Now the river reached it, filled it up, but it wasn't going to stay full because the desert sun was going to evaporate it away. And the only kind of water that was coming into it with any consistency was runoff from these irrigated fields, right? The runoff, of course, contains all kinds of pesticides and herbicides, right? And that kind of water is going into this Salton Sea, which already had a degree of salt because it's a salt-based bed. And it seemed like this new desert oasis had formed up before the problems started, because problems did start, right? 20, 30 years go by, people are looking at it. It's like, hey, we've got a new recreational area, not too far from Los Angeles, even closer still to San Diego, but all kinds of people, rich, poor, famous, not so well known. Everybody was flocking into this area for recreation. They had boating, fishing, right? They stocked these lakes with, or this lake, this sea, the Salton Sea, with four main breeds, which included tilapia, which proliferated, right? The tilapia went crazy in there. Everything was just perfect for them. So much of it, like, you just throw a net in and you'll come up with tons of stuff, right? It got to be kind of bad. And but for a while there, in its heyday, what a great place it was to live. So these villages, like Bombay Beach, started springing up. People were buying lots, and they would come out on weekends. They'd stay for a week or 2 weeks. Maybe school teachers would come for the summer, things like that, right? It was a getaway, and it was not too far, you know, not too far from major population areas to go to. But then the problems began. So the heyday was really like 50s, 60s, but when you got into the 70s, this is where the problems started to really show their face. The salinity of the water went up because the evaporation levels went up, and the pollution levels went up because the years and years of runoff finally started to compound, right? All these things worked together. So you started having a receding, you know, receding waters, right? A drying lake, and you started having massive fish die-offs, right? Tilapia by the millions, literally by the millions on the shore. You know, 2 foot thick and maybe 50 foot up a bank all the way around, right? And the smell, you know, you can't smell images, you can't smell video, you can't smell the words of a story, but the stink is probably indescribable. If you've ever been near just a bay in general, it smells horribly. But that is a horrible multiplied by horrible situation. So it was really bad, right? And the more it dried off, the more the seabed was exposed to the day, and the chemicals that had settled there from all the herbicides and pesticides, they would come up with the winds, and they would make these dust clouds that would drift back to Los Angeles, right? Against the general flow of weather as it was, but that's what it would do. This pink dust would rise up and go to Los Angeles, who already had their own problems because LA is down in a basin and they got all the smog. Growing up in the 70s, your Generation X, you know about that, right? Because it was always a news item. That's what Los Angeles was. It was a smog city. All the traffic, all the air pollution, and it all trapped down in this basin surrounded by hills to all sides, right? So, and then you had this pink dust drifting in to mix with all that. You had some issues going on. People were panicking, right? So people stopped going out to the Salton Sea. It became pretty much a ghost town. There's a handful of people out there now that are collecting like retirement income, you know, fixed income checks that they bought into it. They're stuck out there. And you got some families that are on the government tit that decided that their dollar goes further if they go live out there. You know, and they got a couple of kids, and it's, they're almost like wild animals. I see videos on the YouTube, on social media about the place, and wow, it's horrendous. And I can't help but think, you know, previous episode I was talking about the Dust Bowl, right? The John Steinbeck book involving the Dust Bowl called The Grapes of Wrath. And in that, you had the dust come up from poor farming practices. That was the beginning of the Dust Bowl problem. These dust storms would come up. They'd flow in, and they'd kill everybody's crops, and they wiped out an area. It was already during the Great Depression. All kinds of problems were happening. People who owned land had to give it up to the banks. People that were working the land had to flee from it and find other work to do. And the story that John Steinbeck wrote, The Grapes of Wrath, involves people in Oklahoma during that Dust Bowl situation who were coaxed into going to California to settle out there. And when they got out there, it wasn't exactly the dream world that they were sold. There was a lot of problems. And that's what that story, The Grapes of Wrath, was all about. You know, the trials of the Okies during the Dust Bowl years. So isn't it kind of ironic that a desert oasis would spring up in Southern California, and then it would turn, you know, into an ecological disaster that raised up what? Dust, this pink dust, and went back to LA, and it went back to these areas that had mistreated the Okies, right? I think about that when I think about this story. So you look at it now. Like I said, it's damn near a ghost town. I mean, it probably qualifies as a ghost town. There are some people that live there, but the numbers are very low. And there's a lot of abandoned, really, trailers, right? Trailers. It was kind of a trailer park community. And that's something I should get into also, because, hey, I may be talking to somebody 100 years out in the future, right? The old, as I call them, the 22nd century schizoid men out there. God only knows what the world looks like to y'all, right? I'm sure it's a lot different than what I'm looking at here, because this is a lot different than things were 100 years prior also, right? But for you 22nd century schizoid men, let me tell you a little about trailers and trailer parks, okay? When I say a trailer, I'm talking about a mobile home, right? A mobile home. These mobile homes became an entity and a subsequent culture starting in the 30s into the 40s. There became like a military need for homes that were mobile, communities that could be raised up quickly, you know. And during wartime, you would start to have factory production of, you know, wartime materials, ammunition and whatnot, all kinds of stuff. And a lot of that manufacturing will be established near large military bases for the logistical efficiency of things, right? And you would have to have people work these factories to make these goods to support the war effort. So a couple of the larger and more prominent examples of this happened down in Alabama and in Mississippi. So you started having these mobile home communities forming up to support the war effort by working these factories and manufacturing wartime goods. And this is why trailer park culture kind of emanates out of the South. This is my historical understanding of that anyway, right? When you think of a trailer park, when you people who know anything about trailer parks, it always has a Southern slash redneck slash, and I hate it, but I'm going to say it, white trash flavor to it, right? So you got these mobile homes, these trailers, right? They're trailers, they're called caravans, they're called mobile homes, manufactured homes. They're all mobile homes in general. And by mobility, I mean they can be towed, right? They're not fixed to the ground. They can be strapped down. There's hurricane straps, for example, tornado straps, high wind devices that you strap these things down with so they don't go, you know, rolling down the road like tumbleweed every time the wind kicks up. But they're basically set on a base, which is on top of a foundation, but raised up off the ground. They have little skirts. You have access beneath them to all the plumbing and electrical and everything like that. And they're the size of a trailer that you would tow like with a tractor, an 18-wheeler, right? You had the 18-wheeler situation. These homes, the single units, would fit right on that, and you can move it from one community to another community. Now, if you're really fancy, you'll have a double wide. That's basically two of these slapped together with a connected open area. But still, it's two of them times one, right? There's still two different, two individual units, both of which can be moved on two separate trucks. So it's that mobility factor. And what happened was, once the war was over, America started into its urban sprawl, right? Its suburbia began. These planned communities started to happen in the Northeast, like Levittown, Long Island, right up in New York is the prominent one in history up there. These planned communities outside of the city, which were made specifically for veterans of the war, right? They would get their job, they'd be working a factory or whatever, some kind of blue-collar work, and they were afforded a situation where they can go live outside of the city, have their own kind of house and garden, and live like that, rather than be stuck in the apartments in the cities with families and things like that. It was a big transition in the culture in this country and in the world in general. It was a step up, you know. People got to live a better, probably healthier lifestyle. I'm not a big fan of it personally because I prefer rural America myself. But this in-between state we call suburbia is probably better conditions in general than the cities are, you know, for living anyway. Everybody should live in a city somewhere along the way in their life just to understand humanity. In that regard, anyway, let me just move on from that. We're talking about trailers and trailer parks and the culture that emanates from it, right? So the trailer parks, especially in American culture, I'm reading to you now from the Wikipedia because Wikipedia knows, right? Trailer parks, especially in American culture, are stereotypically viewed as lower income housing for occupants living at or below the poverty line who have low social status. And this is what I was getting into when I started talking about the burgeoning suburbia back in the 50s, you know, post-war America. Even though you had lower income housing for like blue-collar workers, a celebration of the veterans of World War II, and these guys that were going out to Korea and coming back as well, right, during the 50s, there were still people that couldn't afford that lifestyle. They couldn't do that. So a rung below that, but a rung above the apartment and ghetto life of the city, were these mobile home communities, these trailer parks. You can get a trailer for cheaper. You could rent it for cheaper and be out away from the hustle and bustle of the city, right? So that started to come into fad and fashion right alongside of suburbia springing up, right? It was an even lower income suburban type of life, a lifestyle. But it eventually became associated with rural living. People living out in rural America who were poor, who were low income, began to form up mobile home communities out there. So you're even out of the suburbs. Now you will find these mobile home communities, these trailer parks, both in suburbia and in rural America, out in the country. So anyway, lower income housing for occupants living at or below the poverty line who have low social status. Now, culturally speaking, right, there's a culture that emanates from this style of living. First of all, look, I'll say it again. We're talking about low-income people, and low-income people, in many cases, probably in most cases, I don't know who does the math, but these are problem people, right? Desperados, I call the situation, and I don't mean to speak of it apart from it. I'm talking as part of it. I've been desperado in my life. I consider myself working poor. I am not beyond living in a trailer park. I'm not. In fact, and I'll get into this, me and my wife actually kind of aspire to it. There's cultural reasons too, but let me get into the culture a little bit, you know. Because it's low income, there's negative connotations, and rightfully so, because you're in a class of people who are in desperate situations. They're there because that's what they can do, right? If they can do better, they would generally do better. People are like that. Unless you're raised in that, it's generational. So it can be the case that that's all you ever knew, and that's where your comfort level lies. And see, that's kind of where my wife and I are. Our comfort level is kind of there. We as people are different because we live better, right? We live better. We are working poor. We're also sober. We don't party it up. We're religious and moral. So we're different than we used to be. I am certainly a lot more different than I used to be. Speak for myself, really. But nonetheless, I'm more comfortable socially in this lower income environment than I am in a advanced income environment, like our church is, right? Our Orthodox church is very, very nerdy. People are well-to-do. They live a comfortable, easy lifestyle. They're mostly white-collar, not blue-collar. And while they're very cordial to me, and these are people that I love and respect and admire, I'm not comfortable in most cases. Because I'm from a different class, and I don't mind that. I don't aspire to anything more. I'll get into that too. But it has its negative connotations because of the situations that put people in a trailer park and keep people in a trailer park usually involve crime, right? Having had gone to jail. You come out of jail with a record, you find it's difficult to find a place to live. It's difficult to find a place to work. Life becomes difficult at that point, right? So your options become limited. That's one thing that keeps you there. Drugs, which is crime in certain places, certain drugs in certain places is crime, and it begets crime. So it's kind of hand in hand with crime, right? Drugs and crime. And again, with having had spent time in jail as a result, then you come back to a lifestyle where you're surrounded by criminals and drug addicts. With drug addicts, you start to bring in people who are psychologically challenged, right? Have issues, have mental health issues. So that becomes an element of it. You see what I'm saying? And all these things are attached to each other. All these things beget each other. It's a very vicious cycle. And many people find themselves pinned under the weight of it, unable to lift themselves out like a phoenix out of the ashes, right? Trapped down there, locked into it. The culture that is derived from this sort of lifestyle is known as trailer trash, right? Trailer trash. Trailer trash is a derogatory North American English term for poor people living in a trailer or mobile home. It is particularly used to denigrate white people living in such circumstances, which is messed up. I don't know why Mr. Wikipedia decided to go racist right there. The trailer parks that I'm familiar with, and I've got some experience in them, they were mixed communities. I don't know why it's got to be like a racial thing, you know. They're racially mixed, culturally diverse, but at that low-income level, it's a culture unto itself, right? It's a low-income culture within a mobile home community that has flavors of low-income variants of other cultures. If you want to call white a culture or Hispanic a culture, you know, the different foods, the different music, the words that are used and interchanged, that's what culture is made out of, right? Trailer trash is derogatory. It can be insulting. Trash, I mean, you're calling people garbage, crying out loud. But it's not a racial thing at all. It's really messed up. It's really messed up. And I hate that racial stuff anyway. Now, trailer, just as a word, right? A distinction between the North and the South, the blue and the gray, right? The Mason and the Dixon and the Yankees and the Confederates. The word trailer. Up North, the way they divide the word trailer up is by its root word, which is trail, right? A trailer is somebody who works trails. So we would speak the root word trail and then put that suffix of er at the end of it. So you got trailer. Mobile home is a trailer. Here in Texas and across the South, the word is divided up differently. It's not trailer, it's trailer. Lur, right? You catch that little subtlety? I caught that when I first got down here having conversations with my ex who spoke like that. She was a native Texan, probably still is, you know. Maybe not, I don't know. Don't much care. But that's how she spoke, and I caught that. I was like, yeah, it's different. I don't know what the logic is behind it, and then I would hear other people use the word trailer and words like it and divide it the same way. So that's just a little subtle difference. I just thought I'd throw that in there. It's something that came to mind, you know? Some interesting accent linguistics. Now, speaking of trailer trash, right? Trailer trash. In this game, Grand Theft Audio, and as I read it to you before, you had three protagonist characters, right? One of those three characters is a real ruffian and a real scumbag. And you could choose to play any of these three as you're going. You could switch on the fly whenever you like. My wife and I, when we get to play in this game, we get to just sticking with this one character. And the one character we stick with is the one that's named Trevor Phillips, right? Trevor Phillips. Okay, he's the one that lives in Bombay Beach, which is called Sandy Shores in the game. He's an outlaw. He's a real scumbag. And he's out there away from society as in general as the game begins, right? But he starts to interact with the city as we go. All right? Trevor Phillips is a character, one of three playable protagonists alongside Michael DeSanta and Franklin Clinton of Grand Theft Auto V. He appears in the game's multiplayer component also, Grand Theft Auto Online. He is a career criminal and former bank robber. He leads his own organization called Trevor Phillips Enterprises and comes into conflict with various rival gangs and criminal syndicates as he attempts to secure control of drugs and weapons trade in the fictional Blaine County, San Andreas. Right? So this is the kind of guy that he is, basically. I mean, that's what he does. But how he is something else. He's kind of dirty, filthy, vulgar, immoral, without boundaries, very violent, aggressive, explosive, rage. He's not a good guy. Right? He's not a good guy at all. But that's the character that we choose to go with. And the funny thing is that I started playing the game a little when we first got it, ahead of my wife. She didn't play those type of games generally. And she was sitting there as I was playing it, and I got her involved with it. And she saw the character that I was using, and she just named the guy Earl, right? E-A-R-L, Earl. Having no idea that his name was Trevor, she just called him Earl, and that's who he is, right? He's Earl whenever we play. In fact, we don't play Grand Theft Auto 5. We just play Earl, and that's how we roll. That's how my wife calls it, and I like it. I think it's funny. She's funny, and I think of him as Earl the Rager, right? The Rager. Why? Because when we played a game, right, this game has a storyline to it. So many games these days have storyline components that you follow through, right? And I did, but I'll do that on the side while she's asleep or something or off doing something. When we play together, we just rage. We get a character, right? And we grab guns and ammo, we steal a car, and just go make havoc. And this is how we blow off steam, how we vent the aggravation of the day away. On some days, we don't do this every day, right? Probably more frequently than people in their 50s ought to be doing it, but we've done no such thing for many years either. This is all lately. We got the TV and the PlayStation and all that. It's already starting to peter out, right? Tire out a little bit. But there's nothing wrong with it when it's the end of the day and the work is done. Kill off an hour, right? So we got Earl the Rager, because we use the character Earl Trevor Phillips for these rages. And raging involves automobile theft and reckless driving. Like, you're crazy. You know, I'm talking about commuter traffic and drive right, pass left. Forget all the rules of the road when Earl's going. He's all over the place. In fact, sometimes we'll just go, like, on the Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset Strip, that part of the game, and just ride up and down the sidewalks and just take out people by the dozens. Just mashing them and killing them and not caring. You know? That's just how violent that game is. You don't even have to get out of your car. You're wreaking havoc. So you have this automobile theft to get the car. You got reckless driving going on, like I just explained. A lot of police chases, right? You get the cops pissed off. They come at you, and you're running from them, crashing into them. If they immobilize you, you get out of the car, you start shooting cops and everything like that. Things that we would never do, right? Never do on a lot of levels. But it gets the frustration out. Armed robbery, mass killing, you know, grenades and explosives. There's a blimp, like a Goodyear blimp floating around the sky over Los Angeles half the time. You shoot that thing down with an RPG. You know, how many people inside? I don't know. You shoot down the police helicopters. You get in these rages. You know, like I said, just driving down the sidewalk, you kill a dozen people quick. Mass killing. There's even kidnapping. I'm going to get into that a little bit later, right? Because it's a little freaky for me. And of course, there's like prostitution. You can pick up prostitutes. You play like, me and my wife don't do this, but you can. I thought of it because I was trying to accomplish this one thing, and I picked up a prostitute in order to do that. It didn't work out what I was trying to do, so I stuck with this, and I just shot her, right? And I started thinking, hey, so many of the serial killers, A, first of all, they come from California, right? Not all of them, but so many of them do. And B, when they're serial killers, they have this propensity to, like, pick up prostitutes and kill them and, like, dismember them and bury them, all that weird shit, right? So there's that part, potentially, to raging, if you want to go that way also. The kidnapping thing, I'll save for a little later. So just, we'll put a sticky note on that one and come back to it. So Earl, right? My wife calls Trevor Earl, so I do now too, right? So our character, Earl, the name, it's an irony, right? Earl is a term of nobility. It's specifically British. English nobility. It is the equivalent of what you would have in France or Transylvania, like Count Dracula. It's a count, right? C-O-U-N-T. And probably, I would imagine, the noble status of somebody that runs a county, right? You are that elevated as like the landowner of a county for everybody who lives in that county, pays taxes up into, right? It's at that level, county, and it's an earl who's a count in British terminology, right? So the earl's wife would be a countess, not an earl-ess, but a countess, it is, right? In England, you have countesses, but you don't have counts, you have earls instead. But it's that level of a county in terms of rule, right? Noble rule. But our earl has nothing to do with any of that. Our earl is just quote-unquote earl. And he's far from noble. I tell you, at the end of the game, he's got countless millions of dollars to burn. But he's not noble. He's not noble at all, right? So the irony of it all, Earl. Now, Earl, he lives in a trailer. This is how we start out. We decide that we're going to play Earl and go on the raging and get some, burn some steam off, turn the game on, and we start out in Earl's trailer, Earl's mobile home. Now, these mobile homes in Bombay Beach are old style, 50s, 60s, into 70s. And that's where they left off, because that's the period in time where everybody abandoned that area and got the hell out because of the negative environmental impact that had occurred with all the runoff from the agriculture, right? Like I talked about earlier at length. So Earl's trailer is one of those old style, I would say 50s or 60s trailers. It's dilapidated and it's a scum pit. He shares it with a couple of cousins who come and go. He's gone most of the time. But when you walk in the door of that thing, I mean, it's basically a kitchen area with a couch. And then there's a little bathroom and then there's a small bedroom in the back. Shit strewn everywhere. Garbage of every sort, you know, old food rotting away. There's rats running around on the floor. There's roaches crawling all over everything, right? And they're visible. They're moving. The video game is insanely precise. There's so much detail. There's so much to discover. You just spend hours and hours and hours, and you think you've seen it all, and then all of a sudden, you ain't seen nothing. This happened to me just the other day, and I'll get into it momentarily. When I talk about that kidnapping stuff, it'll probably be in a future episode coming down the road, part of what I'm talking about here, probably part two or part three, something like that. Time is starting to get away from me here, as usual. Earl's trailer is a scum pit, right? But it was funny, you know. At one point, Earl took this Mexican woman. It was the wife of some criminal warlord, right? Some syndicate cartel guy. He took hostage to hold over that dude's head and brought her back to the trailer. Well, she got a crush on Earl. This is how the story goes. And she started to become like the mother figure in the trailer. She was kidnapped. She was being held hostage. But she started to clean up the place, started to cook meals for these guys, and just became like a very lovable character who was working in a matronly manner to change the lives, at least the quality of life, for these scumbag characters, right? It's kind of funny. And then she had to go back home as part of the arrangement, right? The deal was struck with the criminal mastermind dude, and he got his wife back, and then the place returned to its scum pit former self immediately. You know, like no time went by, and it was disgusting again. Now, this Earl character, and all the characters in all these Grand Theft Auto games, you can kind of dress them up and style them up the way you like them to be. And in this case, this guy comes out looking like I used to look in my trailer park days. I didn't mean for it to be that way. I just chose a long, unkept mullet over like shaved head and short haircuts and things like that. Because, you know, given the choice, if I had like a full head of hair, I would let it grow for years and years. That's what I did last time I still had hair, was grow it all out. So the character, I just kind of did what I would do. I'd grow it out. The closest thing was a kind of a long, unkept mullet, and he had a full beard. You can have the choice is actually surprisingly limited compared to previous iterations of Grand Theft Auto. So I end up with a guy with a full beard, a long mullet, thinning on top, right? And he's just wearing like a dirty white t-shirt, jeans, and work boots. He looks like I looked in my trailer park years, right? I have to pinch myself sometimes running through there. It's like, is that me? You know, is that me? I'm not. But different than Earl, right? I didn't. Earl had a Mexican woman in his trailer fixing things up, right? When I lived in a trailer, I was getting away from a Mexican woman who was ruining all my shit all the time. There's a little bit of a difference there. I might have looked like him. I may look like him. He may look like me. But where the Mexican women come into the trailer situation is opposites. One's coming, one's going, and never the twain shall meet, right? It's all kind of funny, though. It's all kind of funny. I was actually ditching my Mexican woman while he was bringing one into his life. And in those days, right, those days, I was in the South Fork Trailer Park here in Texas, right? Which is down street from the actual South Fork Ranch, which was the famous ranch from J.R. Ewing and the nighttime soap opera from the late 70s and through the 80s called Dallas, which I bring up fairly frequently because it's still part of our lives with flea markets, gun shows. We have reason to go there periodically. I talk about it periodically. It's also somewhere, it's, you know, the whole open to the public for visitors and tours and things like that. It was a very, very popular television show back in the day. And it's got a fan base that's international, global. You go on a tour, you'll be in there with Dutch people and German people and people from England. They come from Europe. They come from all other places too, right? It's something else. But anyway, yeah, there's kind of a strange dynamic when at one end of the road, you got the South Fork Ranch and its little mansion. It's, I guess you call it, it's a big farmhouse. And then just down, I don't even think it's a mile. Well, it's actually the next road over. There's a South Fork mobile home community, a South Fork trailer park. And that's where, when I lived in a trailer, that was the community I was in. I rented over there. I didn't own the place. I rented over there. And I was there less than a year. Getting away, ditching that Mexican woman, but I ended up going back to her. She begged and pleaded and made arrangements and tried to, you know, promise me things would change, all that kind of stuff. And I fell for it and I was let down again, right? It didn't work out. But so I lived there for, I guess, like 9 or 10 months, right? And I paid it out for the whole year because I was on a lease for a year. My experience in there was very limited, because I was telecommuting. I was doing website programming as a job. I had broadband internet. I didn't have to go work in an office, so I was home in that trailer all the time. And I didn't not engage with the community outside. I never really went out for anything, you know? I didn't eat much because I was on such a tight budget. I had a nickel left at the end of the month. So I wasn't like constantly going out to get food. I certainly wasn't out on the porch, you know, grilling steaks. I was just never where anybody could find me. I'd get up and I'd get in the truck and maybe I'd go fill my tank. Once a week I'd go get food, and it was very, you know, by the book to the letter. I knew what I was buying before I bought it. I had every penny accounted for. Very tight budget. I was not living large at all in those times. And that's kind of what, you know, places like that are for people in circumstances struggling to get by. But not having any kids, I had no engagement with the neighbors. Now, there was drama going on there, and that's part of the culture. I'll get all into the culture of trailer park living as we go. But you're going to get high drama, a lot of visits from the police and ambulances and things like that, a lot of noise. You know, when it's time for fireworks, there's fireworks. It's always very hazardous because the whole place will light up and fire very easily, especially in Texas, especially in the summer, like 4th of July, if you can imagine. But I've not experienced that, and I don't remember hearing any stories about any of the local trailer parks going up that way, but I could see it happen. It's a tinderbox in the summertime in Texas. You got to be really careful with that. I love fireworks, don't get me wrong. But my experience in the trailer park as a resident was very limited because I was just so secluded, right? I missed it. Like I know things were going on. I had a door out to a deck, right, that was attached to my trailer. My deck would go down to the driveway. There was my truck. I back out and drive away. Next to me, and not far, I mean pissing distance, I could piss off my deck and hit this trailer, you know, if the wind was just right. Not to say I did that, all right, but I could have. If I was drinking at that time, I would have. I wouldn't put it past me at all. But they were that close, but they had their deck on the other side, and that's where all the action on my block seemed to emanate from, right? People who were living there, and then their neighbors next to them, they would grill, they would get together, they'd be up all hours drinking and getting loud, and there was kids running around barefoot in the streets. But I never really saw any of it unless I was out and about. And I didn't care. They didn't bother me. But every other night, you know, here comes the policeman rolling up, the red lights spinning around. Somebody got hurt. Somebody did something stupid. Somebody's going to sit in a drunk tank and dry out for the night, whatever. Always some kind of drama. But I never really knew what was going on, only that it was going on. And I would have to figure every street had that kind of core of drama, and I'll get into that as we go too, right? I do have other experience with trailer parks, and by other I really mean like non-residential experience, where I actually incurred more of the culture than I did as an actual resident, right? I did this I had a friend that I met once upon a time. See, I keep backing up here. Don't let me back up too far, right? I fall off the damn cliff behind me. Once upon a time, I was a community outreach director of a particular non-denominational church in the area. And it was a new role. And the idea was to have somebody get engaged with the community and find out where there were opportunities for the people of our congregation to get out and serve, right? I mean, local mission work basically is what it was. So I first got involved through a food bank, right? A Christian food bank in the area that was attached to the big old First Baptist Church. And so a lot of the people that I met were tied, they were Baptists, right? And one particular guy, he had the fire of the Holy Spirit in him, and he was always looking for opportunities to serve, and he got himself involved in a bunch of things. So I kind of attached myself to him and got a good look at what was out there to do. And before I could really present it back to the church, I had to be involved with it personally, that I can explain it, express it, right, know it from the inside out before I passed it on to somebody. So I got involved with all this stuff. And with this guy, see, he lived in the trailer park, and he had a brother that lived with him in a trailer park, and some of the people that he knew was in the trailer park. And we started to form up Bible study groups, right? Protestant stuff, really Baptist stuff. And every time that I dealt with Baptists, I ended up arguing over some of the finer points, like once saved, always saved. I remember getting in a piss contest with some guy about the Nephilim in Genesis 6, right? It was more of debate forum than argumentative. The people were very kind, right, for the most part. And but there were some times where we were all kind of on the same page, too. We did a thing on certain nights sometimes. We did a thing on Sunday mornings. kind of like a trailer park church, really, is what we were kind of forming up there, right? So I got involved with people, praying for people, working with people, teaching in a trailer park, right? In a trailer park. And when I got back to Texas from Tennessee, I intended to move into that very trailer park and kind of pick up from there. And they wouldn't let me in because of my pit bull. The rules changed in the time that I was gone. As far as rentals were concerned, landlords were able to preclude you from the renting in their units if you had a vicious breed of animal, right? And it wasn't just pit bulls, German Shepherds, Rottweilers, things like that. So I was screwed. I completely had planned on moving in and have no problem, because when I did live in the trailer park, there was pit bulls running around all over the place. It was never an issue, right? The Mexican people, again, I don't mean to rag on them. I love the Mexican people. Their culture, they kind of let their dogs run, even in the city neighborhoods. It doesn't make sense. It's kind of dangerous for a lot of, well, for everybody, for the dogs, for the people around. In a country, it's one thing. You know, in setback neighborhoods with large lots, perhaps, maybe it's one thing. I grew up in a neighborhood where we let the dogs run, you know, when I was in my high school years, junior high. And it was not an issue, but there was some territory. It wasn't so tightly compressed. Nonetheless, I couldn't move in, else I would have had a chapter two of Trailer Park Life story, which I really don't. But it was mission work that I did there, right? And to this day, we have friends and family that live in trailer parks. Where I met my wife, the church that we were both going to at the time, you know, it was built up around motorcycle culture. But really, the larger part seemed to, the congregation seemed to be the quote-unquote trailer trash, culturally speaking. Again, I say that just parroting what the culture is referred to. I actually count myself in with that, so I don't mean to be derogatory. I don't mean to be looking down my nose in condescension. I'm not. I'm just saying it how other people say it, you know. And again, it's kind of a comfort zone for me. The kind of people I'm comfortable being around are like that. And I don't even know how to explain it. It is what it is. And it's the same way for my wife. So we have kind of this shared love, this shared enjoyment for trailer park life, for trailer park culture, in spite of the drama and the problems. And believe me, there are some crazy, crazy people, right? If you're there and you're in mission mode, doing the work of Jesus Christ, you will have some answers for people. And then, surprisingly, these people will have answers for you too, you know? Anyway, yeah, my wife and I, we got this shared love for the whole trailer park thing, to the point where we're both kind of looking at each other. It's like, we should maybe get involved that way, you know? Get into a mobile home community and just be the stable people that we are, the voice of reason, the givers, the helpers. It's like, I've been thinking about it. It's like, you know, we're Orthodox, and I mentioned earlier about Orthodoxy. You know, my church, for sure, and I'm betting most of them around just from what I see online, it's full of nerds, you know. It's like Dungeons and Dragons geeks and people of high intellect and people of high IQ that like to flaunt it, that like to use big collegiate words and debate theological points continually, which I don't mind doing. I don't mind doing, but I like a more casual environment about it. And I don't mean to preclude others in my conversation, right? You know, by speaking above them. And some of us can be kind of egotistical and snooty like that. I've seen it. I've seen it plenty in my life. And I'm not accusing any of my Orthodox brethren of doing that specifically. What I am trying to say is, you don't have that kind of mentality in the trailer trash culture. And that trailer trash culture here in the United States has not found its way into the halls of orthodoxy. There's a disconnect in mentality, and I hear nothing about anybody trying to break that door down and open it up. So I got this idea in my head, just floating around up there, just kind of stewing, you know, going back to the old way of thinking, the mission-orientedness, minus all that Baptist stuff, minus all that Protestant stuff, and trying to draw people from a culture that seems to be set apart from what's going on otherwise, and bring it in. But that's a whole lot of heady stuff, and I didn't really mean to get there and go there, but there's something cooking. I see it in my wife. There's something cooking in her head, too, about going out into that realm, you know, returning to that place and doing what's going on there. And I gotta be honest, I'm not opposed to it. I'm really not. So we'll see what happens with that.
This monologue is continued in the next episode. Chapter 00080, Earls of Wisdom, Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.